This is June 17th, 19th. We're interviewing Rene Guerra, the district attorney for Hidalgo County in Edinburg, Texas, in his offices. You've executed the deed of gift form, and you understand what we're doing with that?
Yes, sir.
All right. Here I am speaking Spanish, and I'm going to ask you to please, if you have to use Spanish, but it's hard
That's
for me
okay.
to translate.
That's okay.
We covered the four areas, so why don't we start off with your biography. Who is Rene Guerra? Your parents, where they come from, their names, your brothers, sisters, your own family, their names. And
okay. Basically, I was born in 1945 here in Edinburgh, May the 14th. I was maybe a few days from the end of World War II. My parents were Gonzalo Guerra and Porfiria Guerra. She was born in Cerralbo, Nuevo León, Mexico. And she immigrated to the United States back when there was no immigration, no border patrol, back in she came to the United States about 1905. And according to her stories, my granddad was run off by the revolutionaries because he got into a fight with somebody over a horse that they had taken from him. So they went to Rio Grande, and she grew up in Rio Grande. My dad was born in Roma, Texas. They had a little farm there, about 20 acres. And I only got to know one grandma, Santos Guerra, from Roma. My other grandparents, I never got the privilege of knowing. They passed away, I guess, during my childhood or before that. Now, my mom and dad settled here in Edinburgh when Edinburgh was a lot of brush and very few homes. It was not that very well developed. And back in 1949 or thereabouts, my mom established a little tortilla factory to supplement the family income. And my dad was a contractor, like a farm labor contractor. He took families with us to do field work around Corpus Christi, El Campo, Texas, Central Texas, West Texas. We followed the cotton belt in Texas.
So in-state migrants.
In-state. Oh. Well, one time we strayed over to Arkansas to pick cotton in Arkansas, and we went twice to Florida, to near Tampa, south near Tampa, Florida, to do field labor. I was very young then. I was about 6 or 7 years old. We used to live in army tents near the swamps and snake-infested areas.
While in Florida.
We twice went to California in 59 and 60. My dad took the family over there to do field labor work in grapes and grape industry and peaches and plums. So I stayed 2 summers in California because I was too young to work for hourly wage, but I got to work the last two to three weeks in August picking seedless grapes for raisins. And I spent 2 nice summers in California listening to baseball games and playing hopscotch with girls and stuff like that that couldn't work because we were too young. Now, later on, when I around the time that I graduated from high school, we quit the taking families with us to do field work, and I worked 2 years in a cotton gin in El Campo, Texas, with a cousin of mine who was a ginner. And I was at that time going to Pan American College after I graduated from high school. I was very fortunate with my family. We were 6 boys and 2 girls. My mom raised a cousin of mine whose mom had died when she was 5 years old. And so we brought her up as a sister. She now lives in California, in Fresno, near Fresno. And the others, I have one brother in Washington with families over there working in the nuclear plant and around the nuclear plant in Richland, Washington. And the rest of us are basically located here in Hidalgo County.
Can we get names? This is not a test, but can we get names?
Well, Louis, Luz lives in Washington. He's 13.
That's 30, a male.
He's a male.
Luz.
Luz. Lionel Guerra, who's, he and I own a little 20 acres here where he does a little dirt farming, very poor dirt farming. He's the oldest. My second oldest brother, Lazaro, passed away in 89. Then you had Luz, who lives in Washington. Then Lile Pulido. Delina Pulido is probably the more famous of us because she is the mother of Roberto Pulido, the Tejano music star, and Bobby, the grandmother of Bobby Pulido, who is real popular right now. Then I have another brother, Lisandro, who's a truck driver. He owns a couple of trailers that that he leases out for freight and what have you. Gonzalo is a works with the U.S. Agriculture Department as a crop adjuster for crop losses with the federal government. And I'm the youngest. Now, Maruca or Maria is mom's niece that was raised as a sister, and she lives in Dinuba, California, near Fresno.
Okay. Do you have a wife and kids yourself?
I got married in 1981. I was a late bloomer, and I have two children. Aaron is 15, and Luis, Rene is 12. My wife Maria Luisa Treviño Guerra is a principal at the Edinburgh High School now.
Where is she from?
San Juan. Her family also was immigrants from Mexico, and she was born in San Juan together with three other brothers and three sisters.
I don't think we got your grandmother's maiden name, the ones de Mexico, the Cerrado.
Santos López Guerra was from Roma. I believe she was a U.S. citizen. The ones from Mexico passed away before I was born.
And,
I had their names a while back, and I wrote them up for one of my nephews who's doing a family tree project. But I don't have their names available right now.
Well, early childhood. What kind of childhood did you have, other than the migrant stuff that you already talked about?
Well, basically, my childhood was around taking care of the tortilla factory when we were back home from after the summer was over. We usually got back from the West Texas in November, late October, early November. And that's when I started school, and we would open up the tortilla factory. I took care of, you know, selling the tortillas and cleaning the molino, the milling plant, and taking care of that kind of stuff.
I assume this was corn tortillas.
Corn tortillas. Mom made some of the best corn tortillas and tamales that were known in Edinburgh. I was very proud because her sister, Andrea Olivares, also had a tortilla factory in Rio Grande. And they both had basically the best corn tortillas, I think, in South Texas, honestly.
Did the business grow?
It didn't grow because my brothers and sisters were not into the business kind of frame of mind. They didn't see themselves being tortilleros and tamaleros and stuff like that. Where now, it's a booming industry.
Yeah.
And now people are millionaires selling tortillas, where before it was not as popular as peanut butter and bread.
Mm-hmm.
But now, every corner you see a taco stand.
Any significant memories? What schools did you go to?
Well,
memories?
I had, my memories were pretty good, other than flunking second grade, because I did not spend enough days in school, as I recollect. That sort of instilled in me the competition that I was going to prove to the people that I was not dumb. So I started out to be an A student, and I was fortunate to graduate second in my class in 65.
Now this is in the Edinburgh Public Schools?
In Edinburgh. And I graduated at the age of 20, which was 2 and 3 years older than the kids who didn't have to work, and a lot of them who were not migrants, who had not had to do that kind of work. My memories were are very fun, even though it was hard work, labor. I was one of the best cotton pickers as far as my family was concerned. I would pick my older brother and sister, because I was a hustler, you know. I was a competitor. So, I mean, we were used to hard work like a lot of other migrant families are.
Hmm. Were you Spanish dominant?
We were Spanish dominant.
At that point. Did you get into a zero grade at first? Is that why you got older? Because you only flunked the second.
To be honest with you, my going to school was very fuzzy, except that I cried a lot the first 2 days. And I hated school. And I left school and went home, and my mom brought me back with a little whipping stick. Took me back to school, and so I stayed there. And it was a miserable first couple of years because I was used to the field work and not going to school. So my mom and dad were very firm about the importance of education as being our family salvation from the migrant cycle. And so they were very up ahead of in years of ahead of everybody else. Mm-hmm. That's all the importance of education.
So as you got into junior high, when did you get your first car, your first day? Did you play basketball, football, or were you too old that they disqualify you?
I couldn't play sports because first I was a runt, very very thin, very short, and my parents didn't let me get involved in sports because of the work that I had to do around the house. Mm-hmm. With a tortilla factory. Mm-hmm. I was overaged also. So I don't know if I started in pre-K or, to be honest with you, I don't know whether I enrolled in school. I seem to believe I enrolled at school at when I was seven. Mm-hmm. That's my recollection, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And I never bothered to look for the educational records that Edinburgh School District probably has warehoused somewhere.
Well, in high school, any significant memories from high school?
High school, basically I was in advanced classes. I was very shy, not too sure of myself. I was, a lot of people said I was a brain and that didn't have a social life. But basically my social life revolved around the house and the tortilla factory, to be honest with you. I used to, when I first started driving at the age of 17, I used to take tortillas to the various schools where my mom used to sell tortillas for the enchiladas that they used to have and the tacos that were prepared at some of the school cafeterias. So our work started early in the morning on Fridays when I used to take the enchiladas, tortillas for enchiladas. So before I went to school, I would make the deliveries and then go to school. When I was at the Edmore High School on Freddy Gonzalez, which is now a junior high campus. Mm-hmm. My memories really revolved around traveling. I got to see a lot of places. Saw acts of non-appreciation for our race, as far as, not race, but for Mexican American Hispanics. Run out of some places. Those were unfortunate, where we were discriminated against because we were Hispanic.
And this is in other states or in Texas?
In Texas. And
do you remember any incidents?
I remember one incident where I think I was around 6 or 7 or 8 years old, where we were run out of a restaurant in El Campo that didn't serve. A couple of places threw us out. But even then, when I was that young, I even said, well, why are they throwing money out the door? Where the people didn't look at the economic impact of the Hispanic and the black populations in around the state. It was nonsense for me to see a businessman saying, look, we don't want your money. We don't want to serve your kind here. I was confused when I was young as to why people would want to be in business and run business away because of the social status. Mm-hmm. But as I grew up, things were explained to me, and I saw it, and I didn't see that much discrimination, to be honest with you. A lot of it might have been more indirect, where you were not aware that it was there, but you got the feeling that something was not equal. Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't that kind of normal for the valley? Because there's been so many Mexican population in this area for hundreds of years. It's only when you get out of the valley that then you discover how the rest of the world is running.
Well, to be honest with you, here in the valley, we didn't see it because, you know, we had the barrios and the our communities where we didn't stray that much away from our areas, and we didn't see it from the people that knew us. My mom used to hand wash clothing for some of the business leaders in Edinburgh to supplement the income, and we did not see a discrimination there.
Mm-hmm.
That discrimination, if it existed, was more economic than social. Although it was really never tested. Edinburgh had an Hispanic mayor, if I remember, that I was named after a long time ago by the name of Ramirez. His name was Alfonso Ramirez, who was has always been very instrumental in the in Mexican culture and the Hispanic community, and he was one of our Hispanic leaders from a long time ago.
What are we talking about? 20s, 30s, 40s?
The years.
For that Alfonso Ramirez.
Alfonso Ramirez was the mayor of Edinburgh, if I recall, in the 60s. In the 60s.
Okay.
So, as far as the discrimination, we didn't see it here as much as we would see it elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like the restaurants that I was telling you about near Houston and in other places in Central Texas and in West Texas.
Who and when were you prompted to go to college? And what did you want to be?
I wanted to go to college basically when I was going through high school. I knew that in the grades that I was making in high school, because I'm basically a straight A student, that I was going to go to college somewhere. And Pan American was here in Edinburgh, so I knew I was going to go to college. Whether I wanted to really be an engineer or an architect. But because of low income and not enough funds being available for me to go elsewhere, and also being the youngest in the family that had to take care of my older parents. My mom was 43 when I was born. So by the time I was 20, she's in her 60s. And dad was older.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the youngest, and I was the only one with at home that had a license. So I had to stick around, and I stuck around with them until I got married in 81.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time that I got married, I was about 35 years old,
mm-hmm.
36. So I stayed at home taking care of my folks.
Did you go straight through college, or did you interrupt it?
Pan American.
No military? No.
I got deferment. I attended Pan American. And then I volunteered for the U.S. Army for the draft. I asked the draft board to go ahead and select me. And they did. You know, I got a greeting from Nixon to report. Before I went into the Army, I had applied with the U.S. Air Force to be a jet pilot. But they did not take me because there was too much competition for the few pilot jobs. I could have gone into the Air Force as a navigator. A teacher friend of mine, my high school English teacher, Mrs. Betty Harwell, who was a tremendous person here in Edinburgh, planted the idea of me going to law school.
Mm-hmm.
She was the one who said, René, go to law school and be a great lawyer instead of being a military man. So that's really one of the more influential persons that I had while I was growing up, besides my parents and my...
How do you spell her last name?
Harwell was H-A-R-W-E-L-L. Betty. She's now deceased. But during her tenure there at Edinburgh High School, she was one of our best models and as far as excellent teachers.
So she's the one that planted the idea of being a lawyer in your mind? Did you ever know a lawyer? Do you know what they did?
I knew what they did because I used to sell tamales here at the courthouse.
This courthouse?
Yeah. when it, this courthouse was built in 1953-54. And so when I was about 12, 13 years old, I used to stay here, although I didn't have that many good clients here. So basically, I used to sell tamales in some of the neighborhoods here in Edinburgh. The richer neighborhoods was where I would go door to door, and they would buy my mom's tamales. Like I said, you know, mom's product was one of the best, and I'm proud to say that she even sent some to my friend Kika de la Garza to Washington for some sort of reception, I think, that he had once. Something going on over there where he wanted some Mexican culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mom's Tamales made it over to either to the Congress or some reception that he was having, I think. That's my recollection.
Mm-hmm. In college, did you join any clubs? Did you become political? Did you register to vote?
As soon as I was eligible to vote, I registered to vote, and I voted ever since. Because I felt that the election process was my best instrument for voicing my desires as far as government.
Now, you graduated in 62, 61?
I graduated in 65. From
oh, 65.
65.
Well, do you remember hearing about La Casita Farms, or hearing about Crystal mm-hmm. City in 1963, mm-hmm. or Mathis in 63, in Paso?
Mm-hmm. I remember.
What thoughts did you have about that?
From my perspective, we were Yellow Dog Democrats. That's how we were raised in my family. Now, I always felt that the movements were okay as far as bringing things up to the forefront, but I always felt that it was through the Democratic Party here in the state that we were going to be able to make changes for minorities. I never felt that the Republican Party was going to do anything for minorities. And so, from my perspective, I felt that working within the Democratic Party was our biggest chance of success, from my perspective. As I was going through college and later on the military and law school. I went to law school in UT Austin after I came out of the Army. Because I was a college graduate, the U.S. Army, I passed all their tests, I think, and amazed them, and they offered me to become an officer, and I did. I accepted their offer, and I went to OCS in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, engineer OCS, and later on I was I went into the military intelligence branch with the U.S. Army Security Agency. Most of my time was spent in Fort Hood in field support operations there with some testing that was going on and what have you. I didn't get to go to Vietnam, although at one time I volunteered to go to Vietnam. I was not allowed to go to Vietnam.
Why did you want to go?
I wanted to get out of Fort Hood and the environment that I had at Fort Hood. The battalion commander and I could not see eye to eye on the on what it was to do to be a leader and how to treat men and what have you. I just didn't fit the mold of the old army versus the new army that was coming into being in the 70s, when the military was going from draftees to volunteers, and so the leadership back then was not in tune with a new concept that they were going to have to embrace when the new volunteers came into the military. And so I found myself, anyway, realizing that I was not going to make it a career where I was not regular Army. I was what you call a reserve Army officer, where you could be let go at any moment
mm-hmm.
for any reason.
Well, since you brought up the subject of leadership and leaders, what is leadership?
From my perspective, it's a person. Leadership has to do with those qualities of a person that is able to not only take care of himself, but others. A person who can be looked at to be followed, to be listened to, and that helps direct. It's a person who not only is a doer, but also is a is a thinker, a person who's able to voice opinions, seek direction, and then also direct the people that he's leading to to where the objective is.
Okay. Who is the most effective Mexican-American leader today?
To be honest with you, I really don't know that we have one effective leader.
Which is the most effective Mexican-American organization?
That's going to be hard to say for me to go out and say that this organization is... I think from my perspective, maybe the one that's most influential would be the Hispanic Caucus in the U.S. Congress. Because they wield, I think, the biggest power as far as our national government. And with their votes, if they unify behind certain issues, I think they can bring our voice up more effectively and more vocally and more loudly that can be heard across the country.
A lot of the old-timers have gone. Mm-hmm. Roval, De La Garza, Gonzalez most recently, and now just in the paper, I think yesterday or today, Esteban Torres from California is saying that he's hanging it up. That's a real crisis because that's a lot of years, a lot of seniority.
We have a lot of people that are retiring, but they're retiring across the board, and new leadership, new ideas have to come into the government to see if we can continue to address our problems, but also to seek solutions for those problems that we have not been able to really resolve. Mm-hmm. We have growing problems. Not only in our community, but other communities, whether it be the African American, the Hispanic, the Latino, the Chinese, Japanese, we have problems that are hurting all of us, and one of those problems is drug addiction, that knows no boundaries, and alcohol abuse, substance abuse.
What do you think is the most pressing issue facing Mexican Americans today?
From my perspective, the one that gives me the biggest concern is the high dropout rate from school. Because without education, we can't compete. Without education, I wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have people in the U.S. Congress if it weren't for education and what education got us to the places we were at. And to me, there's a lot of young kids, and basically we are more in tune because of the high dropout rate in the Hispanic community. But any child who drops out of school, from whatever race, nationality, whatever, is a person who's most likely going to be a problem down the road, either through crime, welfare, or some sort of assistance that some of these people are going to require, because they're not going to be able to compete to maintain themselves and their families.
Relationships between blacks and browns, what are the causes of the problems between them, the tensions, the underpinnings?
I think it has to do with the way I've looked at it from the clashes that I've seen personally and heard of have been a question of who's better. It has to do with pride or and sometimes mannerisms. I know that the clashing has always been, I think sometimes may have been lack of communication, maybe lack of understanding of the other person's point of view, perspective. Just like when I was growing up and going to school, I didn't agree with PASO and La Raza Unida parties. Okay, they had their ideas, and I had mine. This is within our Hispanic community, and I felt that for us to be more effective, we had to go through one of the two parties. And from my perspective, we went through the Democratic Party. If you look at the clashes between cultures, when you have two cultures clashing, some may be either through distrust or fear. I think fear is probably one of the biggest factors in clashes between people. Fear that somebody's gonna hurt you, or fear that somebody else is gonna outdo you and he's gonna get the bigger share of the pie. And you're gonna find in most instances probably a lack of communication, a lack of understanding from the other person's perspective.
How about Chicano-Mexicano relations? What are the underpinnings of that tension?
It has to do with the understanding of where these two groups want to go. You're talking about Mexicano...
from Mexico and the locals here.
Those clashes, just the fact that from our area, I think what's happened is that we see things from a different perspective as far as more national views versus the national news views of the Mexican from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
See, in Mexico, they have a different way of thinking in a lot of things versus how we were brought up to look at. When we grew up in the United States, we grew up with different opinions and a different mindset, different nationality outlook. Why would I volunteer to go to Vietnam? Okay. I volunteered for the draft. Every division or every unit that I trained with in Fort Bliss and in Fort Ord, California, every unit that I went to in those two bases, those two forts, the only ones that were not going to Vietnam were the National Guard and the Reserve Army trainees, and a few that went into the clerk, the adjutant general clerk paperwork kind of MOS, the kind of work that we're going to do in the Army. Everybody else went to Vietnam. One of my best friends was the first person killed in Vietnam. The first person from Edinburgh was killed in Vietnam.
Who was that?
His name was Romero Tijerina. He was as smart as I, and even smarter. But he dropped out of school in the 11th grade because of some family problems that he had to take care of. He got drafted, and he got killed in Vietnam. We had Freddy Gonzalez, one of our Medal of Honor winners, went to school, graduated in my class. He went to Vietnam for two tours, and he got killed in the second tour. What causes us to be that nationalistic about it, where we're willing to volunteer and risk our lives for the United States? It has to do with upbringing, with nationalism. In our mindset, in that regard, is a little different than the nationalism that you see from the Mexican side.
Okay.
And if you look at our governments, they're totally different in how they operate.
Okay. Chicanos and other Latinos, well, the problems between Chicanos and Puerto Ricans or Cubans, as much talk of theirs of being Hispanic, but there's some tensions and some problems.
I think those tensions basically are not knowing each other. When I was in Florida, I met Puerto Ricans and Cubans. We didn't understand the language, to be honest with you. And Mom took care of a couple of them because they were... farm workers with us. They came in straight into our camp, and all of a sudden we got two additional people that are working, and I think they were Puerto Rican. We didn't understand. They said they called beans a certain name.
Habichuelas,
and we call them frijoles, you know. And right there you could tell that there's a difference between that person and us. And what happens, I think, when you have people with problems with tensions, a lot of it has to do with communication and understanding, and that leads to other problems.
Okay, well, let's leave that area since we covered it. Let's go back to either the military, or if there's anything significant there you want to talk about.
And the military was very interesting for me.
How so?
Well,
you didn't get along with your battalion commander, you said.
I went into the military And I asked the draft to draft me, and they did. I went to San Antonio. I had already passed the physical because I had already been tested by the Air Force, so I knew I was gone. Once the Army drafted me, I knew I was in. So they went ahead and retested me in San Antonio, and before you know it, by midnight, I'm raising my right hand and swearing allegiance to the United States, and I went to Fort Bliss. One of the very first incidents that I remember at Fort Bliss was that we got to Fort Bliss around midnight after we were flown in a commercial plane airliner that was rented or leased to the U.S. Army to take the troops to enlistees to Fort Bliss. And we were taken to this mess hall where about 40 or 50 of us, maybe more, got out of buses, and we were run through this mess hall for supper. It's about 10:45 to 11:30 at night. And so we get our trays and our plates, and all of a sudden they scoop some rice and something like wolf brand chili. They just slapped it on the plate, and they had milk and maybe soda pop as your drink, and not much else. And so I'm eating there, and all of a sudden, this idiot says, "You got 30 seconds to finish your food, and you're out of here." Well, I didn't think that was right for the proper treatment for the U.S. Government to give its troops, its new trainees, you know, defenders of the nation. So I was the last one to get out of the mess hall. And I had the mess sergeant there glaring at me as to why I was eating slow. You know? So I knew right then that as soon as I finished my tour with the U.S. Army, I was going to come out. I went to the training battalion. They called it the Hill at Fort Bliss. There was the Valley and the Hill. Well, which one would you think is the rougher of the two? The Hill. Because you're always working uphill, more physical labor. The first week, we were told that we had to cut our hair at our expense every week and to have it almost clean shaven. Well, shit, I wasn't going to go spend 99 cents to get a haircut. I was only getting paid $90 a month. So what I did, which was dumb, but I did it. Says they want a white wall as far as the hair, so I shaved all around in protest, okay? And so I'm going through training, and all of a sudden my company commander sees me. And he calls me over, and I guess I must have had the smallest crew cut because it was shaven, white sidewalls, military standard, okay? But he didn't like the fact that I had a little crop. Maybe, I don't know how many, less than a quarter of an inch growing on the top. So he stood me up and ordered me to go get a haircut. I went and got a haircut.
At your expense?
At my expense. Okay, so because after the first haircut, you get that first haircut at your expense. The Army doesn't give them to you. So later on, it was one incident after another. My sergeant, my training sergeant, would take me out of formation and have me take my cap off and laugh at me because of my haircut. That's the kind of relations that I was building up when I was at Fort Hood. I remember one incident, and this one was a little more serious, although I make light of it. We were in the rifle ranges in New Mexico, okay? And there was a young man from Corpus Christi who was ahead of me. And the instructions were that you do certain movements with the weapons. And I was sure that this young man did not have the ability with English to interpret every command. So I was interpreting for him in Spanish because I was behind him. And he was ahead doing his firing exercises. Well, a sergeant came over and got upset at me because I was speaking Spanish to this other recruit. And I don't know whether he was racially biased or not, but it seemed very racial when he says the official language of the United States Army is English, and you will speak English. If not, you're gonna catch all sorts of hell. Well, he told me, a lieutenant came over and told me that. And I agreed with him, yes, sir. You know, he had the command. So I agreed with him. A sergeant comes over and jerks me up and says, didn't you understand what the officer ordered you? And he stood right in my nose where he wanted me to take a whack at him. I know he was baiting me for a physical confrontation. But these idiots didn't realize why. They didn't bother to ask me, why are you speaking Spanish to this other guy? And I would have told them that I was concerned that the commands from the tower were not being properly understood by him, so I was helping him to avoid a mishap. And that's where I felt that kind of a mentality was not going to be good for me to make it a military career. I would not get to be general that way. So.
Hey, I guess if you couldn't be general, then you didn't want to play.
Well, I mean, career, when you're talking about career, rank, economic ability, pay, uh-huh. And I knew that, you know, they were not going to appreciate somebody with a different perspective other than you do it because it's ordered that way. Not because it's the best, but because we've always done it that way. And to me, that's not right.
So when you came out, did you go directly into law school, or did you go back home and party a while and travel?
I came out of law school, and
no, out of the military is when you.
I came out of the military, and I had the GI Bill, and so I used the GI Bill to go to law school.
Okay.
At UT, University of Texas.
Any significant memories from the law school experience?
I had a good time in law school.
Who were some of your colleagues?
I had a friend of mine who's now one of the vice presidents for Pacific Oil and Gas, I believe, used to be formerly known as Valero out of San Antonio, Luis de la Garza. He was a Marine Corps pilot in Vietnam, and he got out of the military, and he and I came out of law school, went to law school together, came out of law school together.
You were a little older than the regular students, no?
Except maybe Luis and I might have been about the same age.
Right.
But the other students were younger.
So did you hang out with the young Chicano students and join the Chicano Law School Association?
We had a law school, Chicano Law School Association trying to, you know, increase Hispanic enrollment in the law school. We worked at that and we tried. Mm-hmm. We had some good parties. We had some the social atmosphere at the law school was a little different than what I had experienced before. It was a little freer. There were some parties that you could go to that might have been illegal. I stayed away from illegal parties where because a lot of people around Austin had marijuana, mm-hmm. especially around some of the student campuses. And so that was not my scene. Mm-hmm. I was not going to throw away all that I had worked for in my family's reputation by messing around and smoking marijuana and doing narcotics.
So did you finish normally 3 years?
I finished 3 years. I had summer tours of duty with the U.S. Army Reserve. I went to Washington D.C. twice the an annex to the Pentagon with the military intelligence, with the U.S. Army Security Agency. Mm-hmm. And so I spent 2 summers up there working on procedures and training manuals for U.S. Army operations worldwide as far as training manuals. The U.S. Army Security Agency is the that agency that is a branch of the National Security Council. Mm-hmm. That gathers intelligence from foreign satellites and foreign communications, and does electronic warfare stuff for the military.
So what did you do?
I was a platoon leader for an electronic warfare platoon. It's a in a field environment, battlefield environment. I would lead the electronic equipment that would jam foreign communications like radios and radars and stuff like that to destroy their communications. That was basically it. And also language interpretation. The U.S. Army Security Agency was the training agency for foreign languages, and because we had the voice intercept technicians, everybody, any language that was spoken would be trained, and we had people that would be able to interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was
Did you pick up another language?
I didn't. I think that basically was left out, left up to the enlisted people who were volunteers for 4 years,
mm.
and above, okay. or longer.
So
my deal was only a 3-year obligation tour.
What made you decide to come here, or was there any other option?
I never had any doubt that I was going to come back to Edinburgh to be close to my family and my parents, who were also older and aging and needed my help.
So you passed the bar and came here with a license?
I passed the bar, even though I didn't do the best grades in law school. I was very fortunate that I didn't have any problems passing the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back to Edinburgh.
Well, did you start up a law practice, or did you get into politics? Or?
I worked with a friend of mine who had become a justice of the peace, Matias Morin, who has now passed away, and a partner of his by the name of Jaime Garza, who is one of our county court law judges. And so I worked with them before I joined the district attorney's office in 77. After 2 years in the office, I was appointed as an acting district attorney when my boss got in trouble legally, and he was removed from office. In 1980, I ran for district judge, and I got defeated in a runoff election with Judge Pete Benavides, who's
now in the Fifth Circuit.
Now in the Fifth Circuit. He and I ran for the 92nd District Court.
And he beat you?
He beat me in
the runoff.
Yeah. And then in 82, I ran for district attorney against Robert Salinas, who later on was indicted and sent to federal prison for money laundering. But I beat him in an election in 82. And well, I've been elected since.
You can talk a little bit about, if you wish, about how you actually campaigned for that, even though you lost, and how much money you raised, and volunteers.
Well, in 1979, when I was acting, the acting district attorney, I was appointed by the Board of Judges because we had a vacancy, a temporary vacancy. I was appointed, and I was in office for about 10 months before I was forced to resign by the Board of Judges, because they did not like my independence and my not wanting to take their
I think you had finished that particular point there. You said you had gotten appointed.
I got appointed district attorney. I was an assistant.
Uh-huh.
And our boss got indicted on a conspiracy charge.
Who was that?
The late Oscar McInnes.
Okay.
He was accused of conspiring to with a jail inmate to want to kill the ex-husband of a friend of his.
Is that Jim Bates and Senator Bates and all that scandal?
No, Senator Bates was one of his defense lawyers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But
no.
There's something similar involving Bates,
no? Jim Bates
his wife or something?
Jim Bates was indicted a long time ago for taking a ring as payment, and they accused him that he knew it was stolen as a fee.
Oh.
But I think he was acquitted of those charges.
Okay. So you were appointed?
I was appointed as, I was a second interim in line. The first interim prosecuted him, and the charges were dismissed. So I was appointed after he resigned with some of the judges thinking he was coming right back. Well, that didn't happen, him coming right back. So I was appointed on January 10th, 1979, until I resigned October 22nd, 1979. During that time, I used the news media to get a lot of free publicity as far as who the district attorney was and what he was doing and what the office was doing. I've been very open with the public as far as the news media is concerned. As I just demonstrated with that phone call from one of our TV channels. And so back then I knew that down the road I might want to be district attorney. So I started really indirectly campaigning by coming out on TV news. Because those are free $200, $300, $400 commercials that later on you have to pay for when you're campaigning. And by coming out in the newspaper and TV and people reading about you and hearing about you, that's advertising. Mm-hmm. So I used those 10 months to build up some of my reputation. And later on, I knew that I was going to run for district attorney.
Now, did you have the lobby to get appointed interim, or that just came out of the blue?
No, it came out of the blue sky because an older gentleman friend of mine had refused it because he didn't want to deal with the judges. And so I was willing to take it because I knew that down the road I was going to run for it. And so I seized the opportunity. I ran into trouble with a couple of judges on a decision that I made on a case. And so they forced the hand and they forced the other judges to as for my resignation, I did. And later on, I ran for judge in 1980 against Peter Benavides, who was one of the judges that had appointed me and that had removed me. And 2 years later, I ran for district attorney, which was always my number one wish.
Now, why did you want to be district attorney back when?
Well, to me, I not only knew that I could do the job, I felt that I could bring a different perspective and a different kind of leadership. My previous boss was a good leader. The people that were trying to grab a hold of the office were not good people. They were too closely allied with the defense attorneys and the defendants and the drug trafficking, from my perspective. And so I felt that their philosophy was not good for the office. Mm-hmm. And so I had been a prosecutor for almost two years, so I knew what true law enforcement was as far as I was concerned.
Were you already prosecuting, well, of course, district attorney, felonies, I was going to say, county attorney, district attorney. Okay, well.
This office is a combined county attorney, district attorney office. I handle all the prosecutions.
So, you still want to be district attorney? Mm-hmm. Are you running now, or you're in the middle of your term?
I just got renominated.
So you'll be going into your sixth term?
In my fifth term.
Fifth term.
Yeah.
That's about 20 years.
On July the 1st, I will have completed 16 actual years in office after I got elected.
As district attorney?
As district attorney.
Wow.
And I served 10 months as an interim and about a year and a half as an assistant.
What is it about the job that you like so much?
It gives me a sense of worth. It gives me a sense of accomplishment. It gives me an opportunity to help people, to evaluate, to do things for... I do a lot of free legal advice here with people that walk in, have a problem, I help them with their problems. Whether it be divorces, custody, land disputes, stuff like that. I give them advice and I send them off on to other experts. So I do a lot of pro bono counseling and stuff like that.
Why do you do this?
I enjoy helping people. I mean, I don't do it for the money because I think if I had gotten into private practice, I probably would be a lot richer right now. I drive a Volkswagen, if that makes any difference. In South Texas, in 110 degree weather, driving a Volkswagen from 1971 without air conditioner.
Well, how do you manage to look so fresh in the afternoon, or you never leave the building once you get here?
No, I'm just used to it. See, I never give up being cotton picker. I mean, the training that I had, from my perspective, that I got at home, the environment, the army training that I got, the discipline. I think that a lot of these jobs require discipline. If you have the proper discipline, the proper attitude, most of the time you should succeed. A lot of people don't have the attitude. And so if you go look at those people, a lot of them are going to fail because they don't have the proper attitude. They don't have the proper discipline. I think almost everything that we do is centered around self-discipline. If you don't have self-discipline, you're going to get in trouble in a lot of... with a lot of things.
In the
this job gives me a sense of accomplishment. It gives me a sense of worth. I put my brand of prosecution as far as in law enforcement, as far as this area is concerned. Hidalgo County is a big county. Mm-hmm. It's the sixth largest county in the state, I think. So, from my perspective, I think we do a lot of good here with the... and I don't do it by myself. I have 34 assistants helping me. And some 12 investigators and some 90-odd total employees.
How many cases do you try a year?
I personally don't get into the courtroom anymore. Because my job more is more management and that kind of stuff. Helping with decisions and...
When did you last go in the courtroom?
I've been in the courtroom like this year for short hearings and stuff like that. The last major trial that I tried was the, I tried the bus accident case where the 21 kids were killed by...
The defective brakes and the Coca-Cola truck or something?
The Coca-Cola truck. I tried that case because I indicted that case.
Whatever happened to that fellow?
He was acquitted by a jury in that case.
Because of the faulty brakes, sir.
Well, that was the reasonable doubt. From my perspective, if he had done the right things, he would have stopped. Mm-hmm. And it had nothing to do with the faulty brakes.
What do you think of the recent overbroad fishing expedition with the Webb County attorney, or is it district attorney?
District attorney. What's happening in Webb County is that there's a federal probe and probably in the disposition of some cases. They have seized a lot of files that I think should never have been seized.
Apparently the number was much greater than what they said they were looking for.
And from my perspective, whoever made the seizures over there was already brought in the seizures. You cannot paralyze a district attorney's office. Now, if you have evidence that if your information is accurate, then you should be able to pinpoint what you want. Okay, but if you tell me that I want 5,000 of your files, then I say that you don't know what you want, because that has been asked of me before through a grand jury. They said we want to see all your money laundering, not money laundering, all your forfeiture files and all your records. And I said, oh really, you want all of them? And so I took him to a grand jury in one of those little dollies, boxes and boxes and boxes, and I delivered him to the grand jury, and they said, we didn't mean this. I said, well, tell me what is it that you want, because the subpoena says you want everything. And here's everything, and I've complied. They wanted to question me on a couple of stupid, specific things. You know, that could have been clearly brought to my attention. And it was all through rumors and malicious stuff that was told to that grand jury. You know? And the deal in Webb County, I think, from my perspective, if there's one defendant who says, or somebody says that one defendant was either bribed or paid money to get off of a case, that information should be very specific. And so it shouldn't require 5,000 files to find that one case.
Some people, especially with the city council people in Houston, in this county you had some prior, not only indictments, but convictions. And in Zapata County, very recently, the last 2 years, the same things. Sheriff more recently in Starr County. Some people feel that, Hispanics are being targeted. What is your opinion?
I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't agree with that one bit. Now, if there's rumors that a certain elected official is making some very funny decisions, whether he's Hispanic, black, white, or otherwise, that should be looked at. I mean, nobody's above the law. Now, we have to realize and we have to be honest about it that there are certain positions that have a lot of influence, that can wield a lot of influence. And if you can wield it, there's a lot of people that are going to try to buy you. And there's plenty of money to go around.
Or at least rent you for a little while.
Well, they're going to try. And I think the problem that a lot of people have is that they're not able to separate themselves from the basic needs, from the luxury desires that they want. See, I'm very basic. Give me arroz and frijoles and potato and beans. I don't need to eat prime rib and sirloin steak and ribeye steak for supper or for lunch. You know, I went to Whataburger this at noon to eat a grilled chicken salad. I could have gone to an expensive restaurant and invited some friends of mine and paid for their lunches and stuff like that and splurged. Why? But that's not necessary. Now, if you get accustomed to that kind of living and the salary for the position only pays so much, when you're going to be one of those persons that the devil, through some of these individuals, is going to come over and tempt you. And if you're weak, you're going to fall prey to your temptations, or to those temptations.
What is the salary for the district attorney?
The district attorney gets paid from the state, the professional prosecutors like this office. My combined salary is about $119,000,
$120,000. I didn't know that. I thought that the county paid you your salary.
The certain populated counties in the state, the prosecutors, so that they will not practice law on the side, where you have a conflict of interest and two masters, the state pays our salaries, and the counties can supplement us.
Lawyer county judges love to do that.
Right. And that's bad.
Practice law, yeah, well.
And the reason that that's bad, and I don't agree with that, that's why in 1979 I joined this county in the Professional Prosecutor Act of Texas that said if the district attorneys in these counties are willing to give up their private practice, the state can assure them of this much salary and whatever else the county supplements them. And I said, hey, I don't want the conflicts. I don't want me to be worrying about whether I want to get an ad litem from a judge or somebody who's gonna put me in a conflict of interest situation. Mm-hmm. It's not good for the office, not good for the elected official.
Do you think Mexicanos, given the dire poverty and the fact that overwhelming numbers are in the underclass, can get justice when this system is based on money?
I disagree when you say that the system is based on money.
Okay.
I think the system is designed for laws and for the enforcement of those laws. The people that enforce those laws are the ones that sometimes causes the problems. If you have an officer or a judge who misinterprets that law, they can be very oppressive, just like a district attorney. I can put people through hell. But if I want to be true to my oath and to my training and to my schooling and true to my character, My job as a district attorney is to ensure that justice is done, and not to seek, not to get convictions. My job is to present evidence. If I have evidence that a certain person is innocent of the crime, it is my job to dismiss a charge against that individual. It's not to seek glory at his expense. See, I don't work on conviction rates. I don't delve into conviction rates. Because when you get a conviction, there's only one way of getting a conviction. It's for you to have the evidence presented, have the law violated, have a jury find the person or the judge find the person guilty. After appeal, if the appeals court say that you have done it right, then the person's convicted. But there's a lot of ways of losing a case. Loss of memory, loss of witnesses, loss of evidence. Stupid jury instructions that only lawyers and judges sometimes can understand, and not even they can understand them sometimes. And you have a lot of people that are not of high school age making decisions. You have some very good lawyers that throw up monkey wrenches into into the beautiful picture you're trying to set or describe for a jury. See, now, it's true that if you have more money, you can hire more lawyers. Okay? But that's not what gets you acquitted. What gets you acquitted is the fact that some of the evidence is not there, and some lawyers are better able to pin it before a jury than others. We got, in some of our cases, court-appointed lawyers can beat us if the evidence is not there. High-powered lawyers can come over and beat us if the evidence is not there. If the evidence is there, and I have the right jury, I don't care whether you bring the greatest lawyer here, he's going to lose the case. If the jury and the judge are true to their oath, if you're true to the oath that you're going to do justice, and you hear the evidence that so-and-so committed a crime and it's proven, then the person ought to be convicted under the law. Mm-hmm. Okay? So it really shouldn't matter on a lawyer if the evidence is there and you're true to your oath. If I'm not true to my oath as a district attorney, then I can take a whole bunch of innocent people to court and I don't care. And that's a miscarriage of justice.
Well, it does happen.
That happens.
And the prosecutor...
And it's shown that sometimes investigators and prosecutors and defense lawyers have not done their job properly, and innocent people get convicted.
Well, particularly in the area of civil rights, where there's a lot of room for error. That involves political philosophies and ideals.
And in the area of civil rights, let's say I'm a law enforcement officer, and I ask you to submit to my arrest. And if you and I are the only ones there, if you resist my arrest, and there's a clash there, who's going to be independent witness that says that you did not resist? It's a swearing match.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, not everybody wants to submit to authority, especially when you feel you're right,
mm-hmm.
and where somebody's oppressing you. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're right. So in the area of civil rights, I know that there's a lot of officers that have no business being peace officers. And in the area of prosecutions, where prosecutors have hidden evidence that would exculpate prove the innocence of a person, those people had no right to be prosecutors. But then I see also on the other side where defense lawyers hide witnesses and prevent evidence coming forth, and witnesses are intimidated, and people get off the hook. Look at what they do to some of the drug witnesses, the drug dealer witnesses. They kill them. Okay. So, the miscarriages of justice are going to occur in every part of the system. The beauty of it is that we have a system in place that everybody can follow to its natural conclusion. And hopefully with the end result is that justice is going to be served.
So what's next for Rene Guerra?
Rene Guerra probably right now is looking at this next four years and then maybe a determination whether I continue for another four or seek a judicial post, or if I hit the lotto, maybe retire.
Would you be interested in being a judge? Is that another one of your goals?
No, not really.
Just district attorney.
District attorney is more interesting than being a judge.
Well, yeah, I suppose you get to get off the sitting bench and play quarterback and run your own place with your team. The judge kind of sits there and lets one side get after the other, and the other side get back after the other and try to walk down the middle.
Well, the other difference, though, the main difference is that in order for a judge to do his job, he's got to be there. I can do my job without being here.
See, because the staff that can follow up, anybody can prosecute as long as they got the chain of command and authority.
And if you have a good office with good people, you really not need it.
What is your feeling and philosophy about plea bargaining?
Without plea bargaining, the system would
clog.
Would break up. You'd have no justice without plea bargaining.
Do you care to elaborate? Explain that?
If you have, this county generated 15,000 cases last year. 15,000 people were arrested. Or 15,000 offenses were committed. If you only have 11 elected courts operating and 3 visiting courts, that's a total of 14 courts. If every person demanded a jury trial, you would only have so many jury trials through the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And even if each judge had a jury trial that lasted one day, you still have a big backlog with other 15,000 that are coming next year.
Mm-hmm.
And so plea bargaining, it has a wrong term. It's not a plea bargain. Like as in, you go to the store and get a bargain because they're selling a $100 item, they give it to you for $4.99. It's got the wrong word. The word should be plea agreement or plea contract. A contract says that if it's good enough for you and it's good enough for me, then that is the law between us. So from my perspective, if you are accused of violating the law in a certain way with certain evidence, then if I make a recommendation that you can accept, that you say that's fair punishment for what I did, that's a plea agreement. You didn't get a bargain. Oh, instead of getting 99 years, maybe you got 50. Some people may consider that a bargain. It's not much of a bargain when you're going to have to do 25 years in prison for killing someone.
Do you agree that they ought to lower the age to try children as adults to 8, 11?
No.
Leave it as is?
From my perspective, the death penalty should only be imposed at where we have it right now, 17 and above. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think that the jurors are going to be necessarily that vengeful that they're going to want to put somebody to death who committed a crime at 14, 13, 15, 16. Because we've had difficulty there in trying in some of our cases. Now, from my perspective, younger people need to be treated differently, especially the violent offenders. From my perspective, the classification of children is where a lot of us are failing. We should be able to pick up little characteristics in our children that tells us that these children are going to be problems if we don't tend to them or see what's ailing them. The gangs were created because the parents were not there for the children. If I'm not there for my children, my wife is not there for my children,
hit the streets.
They're going to hit the street, or they're going to associate with somebody who's going to get them in trouble. And later on, once they start getting in trouble, and the parents and the get frustrated with their children, then the more they're gonna alienate their children. Mm-hmm. I worry where my children are all the time. Well, let's say most of the time. And I look at the people they're associating with. Now, if I didn't care, and my children were hollering for me to be part of their lives, and I wasn't a part of their life, later on I might regret what they may turn out to be. And it would be my fault. At least partially.
Well, I don't have any other questions other than if there's any kind of political party work. You said you're a Yellow Dog Democrat. Did you ever become an election judge? Were you a precinct judge or delegate or national convention delegate or any significant party work? Were you a member of MAD, Mexican American Democrats? Or?
Once I became an elected official, I really isolated myself too much from the party work because I didn't want to have people think that I was going to make decisions because I was a Democrat versus Republicans, communists, and others. I do support the party. I do support basically our ideals, what we propose and what we're trying to accomplish. I know we don't have all the answers because sometimes the solutions that we have are really not the mainstream of what the society and what the nation wants or needs. And I know the Republicans don't have all the answers. And they don't have all the solutions. And sometimes I know that our decisions are based on monetary concerns. And I think that is sometimes the wrong way of looking at it. There are some people who are going to save a penny, but spend thousands of dollars accounting for that penny. And that's what's killing us. We're not doing anything on drug rehabilitation to any extent. When we have our county jails full and the people are given PR bonds, oh, he's nonviolent, he's not a danger to society. Well, the guy may be a burglar. Okay, he's a thief. He can go out and cause havoc in the community. And some people say, well, but he doesn't hurt anybody. But he does. Especially if you're one of the low-income individuals whose house is burglarized, and you have no insurance, and this guy is the one who went in and stole your only entertainment, your only kid's toys, and stuff like that. That's devastating to some families.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't look at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
A child abuse victim, they say, hey, well, we caught him. But by the time you catch somebody like that, and you warehouse him, how many lives did he destroy? See, there's a lot of situation where it's not black and white like some people in the National Congress and other state houses want to make it. It's not that easy. But if you go look at it, most of the time it comes down to the dollar value, to the dollar. How much is it going to cost us?
Well, it costs us plenty. Did you ever participate in the professional associations? Are you involved in the politics of the state bar, or do you do seminars? Or
I attend seminars. I was on the board of directors for the DA's Association.
Okay.
Having to do the Texas County District and County Attorneys Association, which is the association that represents our views, puts on training. Represents us at the legislature, where we're a resource for the legislature on the impact of laws that they want to modify or change. We try to make sure that bad laws are not enacted. We fight them, bad situations that we feel, and we around the state, all of us agree or would be bad for the system.
In this last race, even though you are unopposed and already you're the district attorney-elect, you didn't know that before the filing. How much money did you raise?
Well, no, I was opposed. I won the primary. I won the primary by November. I'm unopposed.
Okay, right.
In the Democratic primary, I didn't do much campaigning. I spent about $9,000, $10,000.
How did you raise that?
Donations that were given to me. I didn't go out and ask anybody for, hey, give me money. A lot of people.
How did you spend the $9,000? Radio ads, newspaper ads, pushcards, walking the streets, volunteers.
I had some pushcards. I had a few radio ads. I had two newspaper ads, and a lot of yard signs and campaign stickers.
Why do you think people keep reelecting you?
I think basically that people that know me and know of me approve of the way of my running the prosecution. And over the years, people have realized that I'm trying to hold the fort here and trying to make sure that our county stays out of trouble and that we have that we get the dangerous criminal off the street.
I would think that after a number of years, you would have eventually tried just about somebody from every family in the county.
Well, and the people that are tried, they realize what they have, and if they got a fair shake at the courthouse, they shouldn't hold it against the prosecutor.
Uh-huh.
See, like I tell people, so I didn't ask these people to get in trouble. They got in trouble. Now, what do we do with them?
Mm-hmm.
Do we put them back? See, some family members come to me and say, I can't handle my child. He's a drug addict. Help me. Commit him to a hospital. They know what they have.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are truthful to themselves, and most of them are going to be truthful to themselves, are not going to blame somebody else for their kids or their child's misdeeds. We're full of excuses, but really when you look at the bottom line and you do a fair evaluation, you're going to know that if you have a problem, you might have created it, not somebody else's fault.
Mm-hmm.
I can't blame discrimination for my not being a millionaire or being a better student when I was going to school. I can't, because I did a lot of self-study. I used to walk across the street to my neighbor's house to go read their newspaper. And I neatly folded it back and put it in their porch. And they still remember. And the friend of mine whose newspaper I used to go to read, he's now one of my first assistants. And we grew up together. We have similar philosophies, similar work ethic, similar environment.
Where do you recruit your prosecutors from? How long do they stay with you?
The most of the prosecutors have stayed here longer than 3 years. I treat my staff very well. I pay them very well. May pay them a little better than some other counties.
What is the pay for starting a prosecutor with no experience?
With no experience, I probably, depending on the law school you're coming out of, I want to pay anywhere from $27,000 to $30,000.
You would pay more if they came out of UT Austin than if they came out of Texas Southern?
More than likely, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it all depends on the training. It all depends on the person. It also depends on the background, the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Law school is a criteria. Law school is a criteria, but not the only criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the interview, I can tell from an interview whether somebody really has got potential or not.
What do you look for?
I look with people that are confident, people that are sure of themselves, people that look you in the eye, people that how they respond. If you look at all these things, you will be able to tell whether the person really has a self-confidence where they're going to be worth their penny in the court. The person that doesn't look at you in the eye, the person that is not confident in the speech, the person that does not communicate well as far as discussions, explanations, and what have you, those are people sometimes that you may have to look at more carefully to see if they really are going to fit your needs. Some people may not know how to read. You don't realize it. If a lot of our children were better readers, then they would have less problems in school.
Mm-hmm.
If you go look at it, because everything almost basically revolves around reading.
Well, District Attorney Guerra, I don't have any other questions. The last one, if you want to say something, area we haven't covered or something you want to explain or elaborate on.
Basically, I've enjoyed the interview and being with you through this meeting, and I hope that whatever I've said is taken into the proper context, in the proper, in the context that it was said. I try to be as frank and as positive as possible. I believe that I can only take care of certain, I can provide only certain kind of solutions. I don't believe that I'm more powerful as a district attorney. I don't try to take care of everybody's problems. We're all in together. If people don't work together, then it's not going to get done.
I did forget something. What is the caseload? How many cases get filed? How many cases get prosecuted?
I think from our I believe that looking at my statistics from last year, we had sort of like 15,000 cases submitted, and I would say a good 14,000 are going to get filed.
Okay.
We have a lot of domestic violence that is taken in, filed, and then dismissed because the women withdraw the protective orders.
In some counties, that doesn't sway the prosecutor. They just keep going.
Well, no, these are protective orders where they go before a judge and they say, we've worked it out, and I no longer want to continue the protective order that keeps the husband and the common law husband out of the house for a year. We have a lot of cases that are juvenile. Delinquency is... delinquent conduct is in the rise. Of course, we have more population. We have more drug abuse and substance abuse. I would say that the vast majority of the cases are going to go into court. There's a lot of cases that don't make it into court. And a lot of times it depends on the victims and their cooperation.
Just for your information, the tape is unedited. It'll remain exactly the way it's done.
No problem.
And it'll be transcribed like that, except for minor correction. Mm-hmm. By that I mean we talk differently than we write. So I'll put periods where I think the period should be and and that sort of thing.
No problem.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time. I'm glad you were available and that we were able to move it up to today.
Well, I hope that this will...